Okay, so we're on. Sorry, you don't have pages on this one, right? Oh, here it says. We're on page 19. So let me just say one thing as a background point that I didn't mention. I meant to mention this earlier in the Sugya. Today, what you'll find is that if somebody wants to go to Beis Din, so they usually sign a Shtar Biruin, which is the document that you sign designating the Beis Din as having the authority to decide the dispute. And by default, that document today says Hein Ladin, Hein Lipshara, meaning that you're giving the Beis Din rishus to decide it either by din or according to pshara. And the explanation usually given for that is because it's mitzvah liftsoa, and according to everybody, mitzvah liftsoa consists in the Beis Din offering the parties the opportunity to do pshara, so that nowadays takes the form of the arbitration agreement, the Shtar Birurin, by default specifying Hein Ladin, Hein Lipshara. And if you want to modify it, the burden's on you to change that. So that's just like an interesting application of where mitzvah liftsoa finds its way into contemporary arbitration agreements. And the second point I just wanted to reiterate is, so which we've spoken about different forms of pshara, pshara imposed by the Beis Din, pshara with the consent of the parties, pshara that is presented by the Beis Din, but then the form of the pshara is actually agreed upon by the parties, the content of the pshara is agreed upon by the parties. And I think Josh Brofman is probably right that the best way to look at our sugya is that this is a type of pshara which is managed by the parties themselves, right? So Rava was giving the parties the option. He's saying, look, Ravina has an offer on the table for Deme Agar Netira. I encourage you to accept that. But that wasn't Rava paskining the pshara. That was Rava brokering the pshara that was offered by Ravina himself. Yes? Everybody with me so far? Great. So now I want to say a little bit more about the underlying value in pshara. So let me say a few quick comments about shalom. We've seen sources that say that the underlying value of pshara is that it leads to greater civil harmony. The Netziv seemed to say that. He quoted the Yushalmi in Tanis, which said what? Nasa din, nasa emes, nasa emes, nasa shalom. If the din is not osa shalom, then it's not good din. That was the Netziv's argument. And we had discussed, we were a little bit on the fence, about the extent to which shalom lies not only at the heart of pshara, but also at the heart of din. Yes? I think that was some question that was raised on the table. Did I make that up? Meaning, so sometimes you could present the sugya as a tension between pshara on the one hand, shalom on the one hand, which is associated with pshara, and din, which is associated with emes. But we have been toying with the suggestion that maybe shalom lies at the heart of din as well. So I just want to give you a few gemaras. One of them is not really so good, but interesting nonetheless. The Gemara in Gittin in Testament Bay says, "Kol Torah kula nami mipnei shalom, darkei shalom hi." D'chsev d'orcher darkei nam chonon sivasah shalom. That's a very intriguing Gemara, but again, it's hard to know with these overbroad statements. You know, I wouldn't put too much weight in it, but there certainly is a thought here that kol nasivo seha shalom lies at the heart of dinim as well. I think more narrowly focused Gemara is this one in Brachos Vavamid Aleph. Anybody get a chance to see this famous Gemara? Anybody here attempt that Daf Yomi at any point in their life? Yeah, okay, so I'll raise my hand amongst you guys. I actually got partially halfway through Moed, right? Yeah. So what does the Gemara here say in Brachos? So we all saw this Gemara. I remember liking it at the time. So the Gemara here talks about the Shekhinah Shorah on 10 people, the Shekhinah rests on 3 people, and the Gemara says, what's the Chiddush of it resting on 3 people? So the Gemara, stop doing this. Ma'o Desema, you would think that 3 people who are doing din together would not have Shekhinah. Why? Because what is din? What is it? Yeah, Shlomo Balma. It's just doing peace, right? It's just creating harmony. Below Asya Shekhinah. So why should the Shekhinah participate in that? And the Gemara answers, "Oh, kamash mon dedina nami hainu Torah." There's also an element of Torah in din. So hard to know what the back and forth in this Gemara is. Is the Gemara saying that the Havamina is that it's just shalom, And the maskana is that it's just Torah? Or is the idea that, of course, din is about shalom, but it's, you know, it's more than that as well?
That says nami.
Yeah, nami. So that supports the second reading, right? I think that's a very nice diak. Kamashmalan, didina nami hainu Torah. Of course, din, the process of adjudication is getting on shalom, but there's in addition a dimension of, you know, Torah in there. Yes? Great. The Nitziv is Lashitaso, commenting on this Gemara Brachos. He says, you know, din is shalom, as the Mishnah Avos says, all din, all emes, all shalom. He cites the Yushalmi, nasa din, nasa emes, nasa shalom. So that's a nice connection that the Nitziv makes between the Gemara Brachos and the Yushalmi that he quotes in Tanis. And then he quotes this pasuk in Yirmiya, which is a very fascinating pasuk. I think the Rambam cites this at the end of Mor Nevuchim, correct me if I'm wrong, that when a person does justice, dan din ani ve'evyon, that's a form of yedias Hashem. That's how the Nitziv reads the maskana of the Gemara. Ned, are you nodding because it's in the Mora at the end?
Yeah.
Right. This is the problematic line in the Mora. Some say that every line in the Mora is a problematic line. Yes, yes, this is the Rosetta Stone. Yeah, so like the Mora is talking about how, you know, you have all these philosophical principles and knowledge and theory. And then in the end, the Rambam says, well, you can't know anything anyway. So true knowledge of Hashem is just in doing good to the poor and to the Almana and to the Yasam. And that's wherein knowledge of Hashem lies. And he cites this pasuk. Right? Ned, did I get it right? Yeah, very, very strange conclusion to the Mora. And the Nativ says this pasuk of a knowledge of Hashem through doing justice, right, dan din ani ve'avyon, is what this Gemara means when it says that there's also Torah in adjudication, not just shalom. Yeah, so it's very intriguing at a philosophical level. How is that yedias Hashem simply through doing justice? Tzchar, you have a thought on this?
I do have a thought on this. I looked up some of the portion on the pasuk there. A lot of the time, like kind of like idofa, so to speak, this pasuk, and try to say, oh no, this reveals yedias Hashem. So in other words,
yeah,
like, someone who does this, that's like a gilui that they do have yedias Hashem, because otherwise, why would they be doing it?
But not that the knowledge of God consists of doing
this action, right?
Yeah.
Or like some people say, like, oh, like, it's like das osi, and das osi is like my ratzo.
Yeah. See that? We were Yotzei Zayin Hashkafashir today. Somebody told me that my father's Hashkafashir was uploaded on my YU Torah thing for a few minutes.
Somebody forwarded that to me.
Yeah, someone's like, I was looking for a shir, and this was there, and this is interesting, but not what I was looking for. So.
Also, if you want to have it not jump around, maybe switch it from 150 to 125.
Then it won't jump around?
Maybe.
Let's see. Is that better? Okay, probably nobody could see now. Is that right? Well, it's fine. We'll let it jump around. I just won't highlight as much. So let me I want to make one other comment about the shalom discussion here and the value of shalom, and maybe it's embedded in din also. The Tur in the beginning of Hilchos Dayanim and Chush and Mishpat Siman Aleph quotes those Mishnayos and others that the world stands on din, emes and shalom, etc. And look at this line. V'kan amar ha'olam kayim, blah, blah, blah. Shal yidei ha'dayanim shedanim bein ish lechaveiro ha'olam kayim. So how does litigation or adjudication keep the world running? So what's the key phrase here? Shmuel, you want to read it for us?
Yeah, sure. Ki male adin kol de'ilim gvar.
Yeah, kol de'ilim gvar. So what does that mean?
Without it would fall apart.
Oh, a little more precise. Without din, kol de'ilim.
All that sort of comes.
What's alim? Whoever is stronger, gvar, prevails. Right. So if not for justice, it would be a Hobbesian jungle, right? Where power just determines who wins. And that's all you need din, right? To make sure that, you know, the world could be sustained in this non-Hobbesian way. So that seems to suggest that... this provides some social function of keeping the world kayim, I'd imagine, through keeping society in order. Josh, you have a hand on this?
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting because presumably sometimes Din says Kolda Luvara.
Yeah, right. But I guess it limits it, right? So at least in some special cases, as opposed to being the rule everywhere. Scharia?
Yeah, I also think like a strong point is the contrast. It says, Olam Chayim, this is Olam Homemade, that, you know, like Olam Homemade things, like Torah, Holy Things, Kaden, the world was created for. But these, it seems like they're just kind of necessary to uphold the world. It's not necessarily like a value or an end to know themselves.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a social goal.
Right.
Nothing.
It's not like going like, you know, halakhic command here of like bringing halakha into the world.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's just social contract value of avoiding a world governed by the use of power. Yeah. Great. So now I want to move into what we left off in the last year, and that is, are there principles of pshara embedded within the psakim of the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch? Right? Meaning, are there some things that look like dinim, or that are articulated as dinim, which in fact are really embedded in this doctrine or principle of pshara, compromise, settlement. Okay, so let's start with the Gemara Bamitzia in Tesamad Aleph, very difficult Gemara, the boat case. To make a long story short, you hire somebody to transport something for you, the journey fails, so the boat sinks in the midway. And the question is, do you still have to pay the fare for the journey, or are you entitled to recoup your fare? Yes? So it's not about the value of the wine that drowns. The issue with the Gemara is about the value of the fare for the voyage. Did everybody get that when they prepared the sugya? Okay. Now, so I like to think of the Gemara in this way. So imagine you're trying to fly to Israel for a bar mitzvah, and Elal leaves you stranded in Athens because of some technical difficulty on the flight, on the plane. So they land in Athens, and you're stuck in Athens. And then, you drop $1,000 on the flight. And then Elal says, oh, don't worry, we have another plane that's going to come get you to Israel by Sunday or something. Spend Shabbos in Athens, we'll get you to Israel. And at that point, you're like, hey, I was going for the bar mitzvah. I really don't need to go. I'm happy to turn around and go home. And Elal says, no, like, we just promised you voyage to Israel. We'll get you to Israel. So we're offering to get you to your destination. And you're saying, no, I don't really need to get to my destination, or you did it in too complicated of a way. I don't owe you anything. That's sort of the debate that's going on here in the Gemara. Do you have to pay for that type of voyage? And the Gemara actually says, well, it depends whether you have to pay or whether you get refunded. Depends on what type of agreement it was. Such that it depends about which party could still perform. So is the contract worded in a way that gives Elal the ability to bring another plane and complete the contract, in which case they're entitled to keep the money and you have to pay up? Or was the contract worded in such a way that if they already have to bring another plane, they're breaching the agreement, in which case you're entitled to recover the amount? Okay? That's the background of the Gemara. What's important for our purposes is the contrast between the case where the Gemara rules. There's one case where who gets to keep the money depends on whose hand the money is in right now. Did everybody see that? That's the imnasan lo yitain v'im. Sorry, imnasan lo yitel v'im nasan lo yitain. I got that wrong. Imnasan lo yitel v'im lo nasan lo yitain. And the case where the Gemara says split the difference of the fare between the two parties. So what are those two cases? Anybody get the, what's the case where you leave the money wherever it is? So which case is that? So Svina Zuva Yayin Zeh. So if you are specific, where you hired this boat and you obligated yourself to give this wine, then you leave the money wherever it is. Did everybody follow that in the Gemara? But if both parties were non-specific and they said Svina Stam Yayin Stam, then they split the difference. What's the difference? What's the difference between those cases? So anybody get the difference? So let's see. Why in the case of Zu Zeh do you leave the money wherever it is? Ned?
Because both parties have equal
So isn't that also true in Stam Stam? Meaning in the Stam Stam case, both party could move forward by bringing a new boat or bringing new wine. And in the Zuz case, neither party can move forward. But in both cases, the parties are in the same position. Either they both can move forward or neither can move forward. Right? By supplying different wine in different boats. So why should that depend whether you say Yachloku or leave the money where it is, Eitan?
I have a question. So
yeah.
Why is it better to, or can you explain what the, like, what saying Spina Zu does?
Yeah. So the Gemara thinks that whoever the party that has to suffer the loss is the party that is in default, the party that's refusing to move forward. That's the underlying principle. So if one party is allowed by the agreement to bring a new boat and the other party can't bring new wine, then the party who can't bring new wine is considered to be in default because he's the one who's preventing the contract from moving forward. That's the significance of Zu versus Stam. Meaning, could you replace the thing in the contract? Does that make sense? Did everybody get that from the case?
Why does that mean he has to pay for the thing that didn't help him get Yain Zu across?
He's not paying. Why does he have to pay for the journey?
Why would he have to pay the rental fare for something that not only...
So the thought is like this. If I purchase a ticket on LL, uh-huh, and I say, airplane Stam, and that's usually how it's worded, meaning they just promise you passage from your point of departure to your destination. They don't say that you're going to be on flight, blah, 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 you know. And the reason why they do that is to protect themselves, that if the flight gets messed up, they could always get you on a different plane. So that means that Alal is not in breach if they land you in Athens and then offer you transportation from Athens to Israel. That's a Stam case. So if at that point you say, hey, I don't want to go to Israel anymore, you're in breach because you contracted in a way that allows them to use multiple planes. And when you say, I want to turn back to the U.S., you're breaking the agreement. So you got to pay the full fare. Okay? If, however, that's like a Stam Zoo case.
Yeah,
meaning you being the Zu and Elal being the Stam.
Right.
And then you have to pay up. Does everybody see that?
I mean, Zu because bar mitzvah? Like, your Zu is...
A Zu because... No, it's Zu just because...
You want to be...
Yeah, it's Zu because you're not interested in moving forward, right? You are saying that you don't want to continue on the flight. That's why I'm viewing it as a Zu case. Yeah. Meaning, given the way what you're interested in, it's not that you could replace your passenger with a different passenger to continue on the flight. You can't, sublet that.
But it's not that you would have to pay the boat fare. It's that, meaning without getting the... In the case of Zoo, in the Alal case, they're still gonna... I guess you would still be given... In the case of the wine...
It's just about the fare.
You don't want to move forward because the wine that you wanted to bring is now gone, right?
Correct.
So
you only have one barrel of wine.
But if they force you to pay, if they force you to pay the rental fare, then you would still get a replacement boat to take across, even though you don't want it, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right, but it's useless to you.
Yeah, but that kind of makes sense, I guess.
Useless to you because you have no more wine to ship.
Right. I was just thinking that you would literally get nothing and you have to pay the rental fare.
Technically, you have something; it's just valueless to you. Correct.
Well, you could still sell it.
Maybe.
You could sublet the boat.
Arguably. Except for the fact that what Zoo makes it is that you purchase a ticket for Eitan Northman. Meaning, you can't, given the way the contract is worded, you can't give it to somebody else. Right? Companies do this all the time. I bought a ticket to Miami. And then I cancel and they give me credit. The credit only works in my name, right? It's not transferable. That's like a Zoo versus Stam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay, ready with me? This is a very difficult case. So why are we going into this case? So in Zoo Zeh, where neither party can move forward, you leave the money wherever it is. But if it's Stam Stam, so both parties could move forward, but neither party wants to, you split it. Why do you split it in that case? So So what does the Rush say to explain that? This is such a complicated case. I probably shouldn't even have given it. But why do you split it in the case of Stam Stam, Ned?
Because either party might kind of trick the other into them bringing the stuff first, in which case one party will now have the conditions met, and then they'll lose out.
Yeah, so imagine this way. You're stranded in Athens. Elal could bring another plane. You could, maybe you still want to go to Israel. Maybe you still could go to Israel, but you don't want to go to Israel. So neither party, it's in neither party's interest to continue the journey. Okay? But given the way the contract is worded, you could kind of coax the other party into moving forward. And then you want them to be the one who's going to say, actually, I'm not interested, right? So I tell Elal, I don't want to go to Israel. I say, Elal, I want to go to Israel. Give me a plane. Right? And Elal doesn't really want to supply that plane. But they might do it just to kind of get me to be the first one to blink and say, oh, haha, I don't really want to go to Israel. Right? So the point is that I don't want to go to Israel. Elal doesn't want to bring another plane. But technically speaking, if I were to want to go to Israel, I could force Elal to do so or forfeit the fare. Similarly, Elal doesn't want to bring another plane, but they could bring another plane to force me to go to Israel such that I have to cede the fare to them. Okay? So why do we do Yachloku in that case? What's the basis of the Yachloku?
It's better for everyone.
Yeah. It's better for everyone. Okay, it would be great if like the Rishonim said that explicitly. I think the Rush comes very close to saying that. So he says, look, neither party wants to move forward. Right, I'm not really trying to get to Israel. I'm not bringing more wine. And Elal doesn't want to bring another plane. So we're in equal position. Therefore, we split it. Okay? What type of better for everyone is that decision?
What?
Yeah, so I think, to me, it sounds very much like a pshara. Very analogous to which case? Sanhedrin, Amud Aleph, the two camels and two boats type case. Well, yeah, similar to that case, because in that case, if you both go at the same time, you're both going to lose. Here also, strictly speaking, you could compel the other party to move forward, but that's against your interests and it's against their interests. So what's considered to be a good, efficient resolution? Oh, just split the cost of the ticket in half. Does everybody agree with that analysis? So if that analysis of the case is right, then this is a pshara because of almost an inefficiency in the bargaining conditions. Right? Meaning like if they were to bargain this all the way through, it's not rational for any party to move forward. So the halacha just says, because of that, and in order to deter people from, let's say, having this bad incentive of just trying to force the other party to move forward when they don't want to, it's better to just split it between them. So to my mind, that's very much a pshara in the spirit of the Gemara in Sanhedrin Lamed Aleph. Does that make sense to you guys? Yeah? Yeah, more or less? It's an ingenious reading of that Gemara. No, it's not an ingenious reading, but I think it's a really good reading by Gemara. It would just be nice if the Rishonim were a little more explicit about it. What the Rush here says, he says, oh, because no one's moving forward, so we just split it. He doesn't explain that this is actually a pshara. Let me just say one thing in Eitan, then I'll take your hand. The Ritva cites the Ravid as having a different reading of the Gemara. Did anybody get a sense of what the Ravid's saying to explain why one case is Yachloku and one case is leave the money wherever it is? Faria?
Yeah, that's whether the visa of the money is like a chalos, whether we take it seriously. If the visa is serious, and we can give reason why, then it's considered a multi mikaber lavaraya.
Exactly.
If there's no visa, then we say, okay, fine, we will apply one multiple suffix yafoku when there's no matzik, no one really has strong possession of the money.
Exactly. So he makes it all sound like a technicality of cheskas mamon, right? Meaning, the way the Ravid reads the Gemara is that this is not really a pshara type issue. as much as a straightforward application of Cheskas Mamon, meaning if you have a strong taina to back up your physical possession, then we view it as a Cheskas Mamon, and the other party can't dislodge the money from you. But if you have a weak taina, what makes it a weak taina? The fact that the other party could make a movement that forces you to move forward in the contract. That would make your position weaker. That means you don't have a Cheskas Mamon and you split the money in half. So this is the Ritva is a very formal way of thinking about the Yachaluku in this Gemara, whereas I think the Rush's explanation is much more in the spirit of, yeah, this is a Pshara because to look at this from the perspective of Din would get us bad results. Right? It's just, it would force one party, it would incentivize one party to try to get the other party to move forward when neither of the parties actually want that. Does everybody see that? So Eitan and then Josh.
Is it like, fair to think of this as like a, I don't know, like Charles almost turned Din? Like, because I mean, the Gemara's saying this as like soft Din.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Charles, to me, Charles seems more like a compromise and like something that's agreed upon by the parties, but it seems like they don't have a choice. Like, yeah. they don't like have the opportunity to opt out of this Charles.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what today's about. This is a Pshara that takes the form of Din. The psak in this case is to split it because that's just the most efficient resolution. Right? So, yes, this is one of those cases where the pshara seems to converge into being a form of din.
So what's the difference between, like, how would you like to make distinctions between, like, this, like, pshara-esque din and, like, normal din?
Yeah. Yeah. You guys hear Eitan's question? Right, so if this is Romy's from last year, if this case is really a type of, so this is the din, right? The Gemara's, notice how it's presented in the Gemara. This is the din of what happens in this type of case. The din is Yachloku. And if we're right that it's a type of Pshara according to the Rush, what distinguishes this Yachloku din from this Pshara din from pure din? Yeah. So we're going to come back to that question in a minute. Let me just get a few more cases out. I think that's the crucial question here. Has everybody been thinking about that question? Yeah. So we're going to think more about that today. So that's one case. We have easier cases of Yachloku. So we have the Suffolk V'yavam Shebo Lachlok B'nichsei Misna. Everybody remember this case? Yavam Muslamid Zayin. You have a son. It's not clear if he's the child of a Yavam or a child of the Yavam's brother. Whose assets does he take? Who gets the assets of the deceased? The Gemara says they split it 50-50. Tosa says, even the Rabbanon agree that you split it 50-50 here because there's no Cheskas Mamon. So is this a Pshara? We don't know, but we have Rabbi Shimon Shkup telling us that all of these Yachlokus in the Gemara are in fact based in Pshara. Correct? Let's look at another example of this, Shtayim Ochs and Batalis, but Mitzia Beis Amid Aleph. What does the Gemara there say? You have two people grabbing onto a talis. What's the din? Yachloku, they split it, right? Shor Shenagach es Apara, the Gemara there has machlokas between Sumchus and the Chachamim. So you have an animal that harms another animal, and then there's a dead fetus or a dead baby nearby. It's not clear if the baby died separately or if it was killed by the goring ox. So machlokas between the Chachamim and Sumchus. Sumchus says, what do you do in that case? So whether the baby animal was gored is a suffolk. So what does Simchus say in that case? Yeah, you pay half of the reparations for a short time. You pay half of a half, which is?
One fourth.
Yeah, 1/4. Exactly. And the Chachamim say, Amotze mechaber al varaya. Chachamim say that the mazik is off the hook for the baby because we have no proof that he harmed the baby. He's definitely a mazik on the mother, right? But he's an alleged mazik on the baby, for sure. Yeah. So I want to look at the Shari Yosher, then I'll come back to this Gemara Mabasar Kaflam and Gimel. So the Shari Yosher says, whenever you have a Yachloku, either according to Simchos that you always do this in a Safik Mamon, or according to the Chachamim that whenever there's no Cheskas Mamon, you do Yachloku, he says, what is that? V'nir lan yazdaiti shedin chaluka b'chiai gavna hu inyan pshara. And he says, this is a pshara that the bezdin could do, bal karchach of the bali din. Right? I think that's a very wonderful Reb Shimon Shkap. It really just takes this whole category of Yachloku in the Gemara and says all those cases are decided under a different halachic principle than the nearby cases in the Gemara. So it's a pretty groundbreaking, I think, analysis, even though Rumi thinks it's obvious. It's groundbreaking in that my impression would have been that Pshara is a license given to Dayanim to use at their discretion to decide cases. So it applies as a procedural rule in Siman Yabez given over to Dayanim about how to decide cases. Reb Shimon's saying, and this brings Eitan's comment into sharper relief, Reb Shimon's saying, no, there are some psukim in the Gemara scattered throughout Shulchan Aruch, scattered throughout Nezikin, that are psukim grounded in the principle of Pshara. So this, I think, changes the way we think of the landscape of Nezikin, and we're saying that even within Nezikin, just like we have rules that are based on Lefnim Mishur HaSadin and rules that are grounded in Din, we have some rules that are grounded in Pshara and some rules that are grounded in Din itself. You guys agree with that? Where Reb Shimon commits us to? Yeah? Karya? Do you agree that it's a little radical that Reb Shimon says this? Rumi, you want to defend your view that this is obvious?
Yeah, I think this. I read all the different. How broadly should I say? It seems clear to me that if you say that in a certain case, well, we go with the status quo, or we leave it with the person who's holding on to it, then there's no reason to assume that that's actually who it belongs to, just because they're holding it.
Well, notice that you're just assuming now that Din is about who does it actually belong to. It's not obvious that.
That's what I said to Kobe and Seder. Like, it's not, I'm not thinking of the finish if you assume that Shara just means, like, a resolution that's not based on exactly, like, the way things should be, or the way that, like, what a person's rights grant him, and you assume that Din is exactly what a person should have, or, that's the best formulation I've
seen. Yeah. It's very tricky. I mean, Ethan just left, but. This is exactly his issue that he's struggling with, right? What does that mean? So what I'm worried about on your theory is that your theory says any suffix, this is where we left off last time.
Right.
You're saying any klali asvekos is already a type of pshara. And I think that's very overbroad. Anybody share my concern?
Why
is that?
Why do you feel that way?
Because then pshara is everywhere in the Gemara. Meaning most dinim, let's put it this way. I would venture to guess that most dinim arise under conditions of uncertainty. So let's say this. Cheskas abatim. Let me say it sharper. I think it's true that mine versus thine, what's mine, what's yours, is partially going to be determined by the rules of the legal system. And the legal system has to take into consideration what happens when there's uncertainty. Let's say cheskas habatim, for example. A property is abandoned for 3 years. Somebody comes and says, I lived here for 5 years, you sold it to me without a shtar. That's a kind of suffix, right? We don't know who the true owner is. And then we have a rule of a chazaka that says, oh, now this guy who's been living here is the owner. So you want to say that's a shtara? You want to say that's a shtara? No, you don't. You want to say I don't know where din exists.
You
say din exists when two eidim come and they say,
if we were neighbors and I don't have a wall, then I have to. You want to build the wall? I have to pay you with the wall.
So in those types of
no sure.
And what? Just like Hezekiah.
I mean, this is an example.
Right.
In a chazaka,
like
you
can
say it yourself. I don't. I'm claiming I've lived here 5 years, I own this property, and you're saying, my comma saying, no, you don't.
So I'm saying, you're saying that any decision that's not grounded in 100% certainty is already pshara. That's your view.
Yes.
Anybody sympathetic to Romy at this point? Ellie, you're sympathetic to that?
But in the sense that, I've heard things along the lines of, like, some sort of kalika is already less than perfect. mean a haluka isn't like a din. It's not because it's saying, you know, I mean, it depends on who you hold, like, I think.
But Romy's going further. Romy's saying anything, any decision that's based on a suffix type principle is already a pshara decision.
I wouldn't take it that far. It's a level at which you would be correct.
Yeah.
I really think it's only upsetting if you think that...
It's not upsetting. Chas v'shalom. I'm not upset. I just think it's very... we've gone, like, pshara now is, like, everywhere.
I think it's only problematic or whatever if you think that pshara means, like, some...
aberration.
Yeah.
And you're saying it's normal, it's just baked in to have the dinim and shofar.
It's exactly like it's what you were arguing a few days ago. Meaning, yeah. Sometimes you have like a straight up thing, but most of the time it's really complicated and kasha, I don't know, and so you gotta just.
Like in the Riyaz, you know, kasha la modal
adin. But not because it's. And therefore it's.
Just because of the uncertainty, just because the epistemic.
It's less than perfect. It is, right. Meaning we live in a complex world and sometimes you need complex solutions.
Yeah, great. I'm sold. I think it's Reb Shimon gets us halfway there, and you're taking us beyond Reb Shimon, right? I needed a little prepping for that. That's all. That's why I have a reaction. You know, I thought Reb Shimon was a chiddush, but you're saying no. Like he's actually too conservative, right? Because he's just like he's saying it about the achlokus, correct?
I mean, how do you understand everything else? Like, why else do you think that says Gimel Shanim or like so much about Rashi stuff? Or Kol Damvar, or Kol
Gu. So you're dividing up the logical landscape between what's certain and what's uncertain.
Sure.
Right? That's Romy's answer to Eitan. Yeah, Josh?
I'm just confused. How are we defining Shar right now? Like, if it's not Din, then it's Shar? Like automatically?
Oh, Romy's saying something. Decisions based in Sveikos are...
So I'm just saying, that's not how I understood it.
Shar
is
kind of Din.
Meaning, I thought Shar was more about, it's one type of resolving a suffix in the sense that we're trying to like compromise and make everything better for everyone. That's how I understood what pshara was. I would say there's like another category besides din and pshara, like other ways.
Yeah. Like seikos, there's like din mi vadai, din suffix.
Latim isn't purely din, but I certainly wouldn't call it pshara based on that definition of pshara.
It's interesting. And the other thing, I would say cheskim vadim conventionally is known as the din, right? This is the rule of ownership.
Why?
Well,
why? You don't think it's because that guy really, really, really owned it.
I think that you own it if it's consistent with the rules of ownership in halacha.
But I'm saying that the rules of ownership in halacha are established out of the suffix.
I mean, why is that like sufficient evidence? As in, if you have stegos, and then you can have dinim, which say X is sufficient evidence, and like shvua is sufficient evidence in this circumstance to trust that it is the case. And then there's ways to resolve stegos into certainty.
Yeah.
Which din.
Without saying this is a compromise.
I don't know that I would use the word compromise. I just think that exactly that. You're saying, given the fact that the guy's not going to hold on to this job for 3 years, and given the fact that he's eaten this much, all evidence points in this direction, so that's how we should rule. And I'm saying, you can call that din if you want. What you're essentially saying is, we're not sure, but it seems pretty likely, so we're going to go like this.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's like Ellie? Yeah, Ellie and then Daniel.
Before any Bezdin does anything, they always tell you to go to a sharp. We're trying to do some sort of chart. Would that have any bearing on what we're trying to talk about?
We spoke about that earlier in the last few shiurim. Here we're more talking about the cases where the dinim themselves seem to be grounded in pshara. Oh. And that's what's so fascinating about this set of cases. Did anybody catch who else holds this view like Reb Shimon? Yeah, it was Zalman Nechemi Goldberg in that piece, right? Right, Arlo, you caught that?
Yeah, I didn't know that were.
Yeah, no, it's a great piece from Zalman Nechem. He assumes that, right? He makes that same point that all these dinim and the Gemara are grounded in pshara type considerations.
All the achloku
cases, exactly. We're going to come back to Zalman Nechem in a minute. So I want to now move to make one further point here before we get to Zalman Nechem. There's a smag in Siman Kuf Zayin, Sefer Mitzvos Gadol, who quotes Yushalmi and says the following. Anybody get a chance to see this smog? Based on the Yishalmi, I added it pretty late. Anybody see it? Zoldi?
Yeah.
Okay, read it for us. Yeah, what does that mean?
So the Anishar distances himself from, with all abilities, so they should not accept upon themselves to the Torah.
Meaning that they shouldn't adjudicate according to the strict letter of Din.
Right.
In the Smato Al-Vavos, there seems to be like they're no longer experts in doing strict din.
Yeah.
Right? And he quotes this great Yerushalmi of Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta. You want to tell us about that?
Yossi Bar Chalafta, about Shnei Anashim, found the Dun Shamul Panav, Almanach Shetad Doninu, Din Torah. The rest of the wanted him to adjudicate based on the Torah, so I'm Alehem, Gini Odeel, the Dun Ithem, and Din Torah. So I'm not, I don't know how to.
Yeah, so just accept my decision, like regardless of whether it's true or not. And the Torah quotes this in Hilchos Dayanim, right, as like advice. And so Hilchos Dayanim Siman Yud Beis, which is about Pshara. So what does this seem to reflect about the value of Pshara? So we spoke about the Shalom value earlier. What does this seem to suggest, Zoldi?
Well, now it seems like it's like the better avenue I sounded just like by default, that's what we're going to have to rely on a little bit. Because we're just not capable of
it. Yeah. It sounds like we're not capable of applying din in the right way in some cases. So the Shulchan Aruch says, oh, just apply pshara because din is not going to be applied correctly in a lot of cases. Right? That seems to be the gist of the Yerushalmi and the Tur and the Smag. Everybody agree with that? Yes? So what does that mean? Why is din not going to be applied in the right way? So one way of thinking about this is the adjudicator might make a mistake, which is bad. Another way of thinking about this is along the lines of the Riyaz, which is what? That... Tzchariah, you want to...
Yeah, as the Riyaz says that, even if we are certain about what the din is, this might be kasha lid, but it might lead to kind of like non-shalom results, or... Just bad results we don't want.
Yeah, like din's not going to bring the right results given like we don't know how to apply it the right way, so it's not going to bring about the right resolution to the controversy, right? So you could definitely read that Yerushalmi of the Smag quotes as consistent with the line in the Rishonim that oftentimes it's kasha lelech achar din. Okay? Now I see Reb Zalman Nechemya's analysis in that article. Did everybody read the article? As very much consistent with that way of thinking about it. So let's survey his view very quickly. So he wants to argue that pshara is preferable in a bunch of cases. On what grounds? Why does he think pshara is good? Kobe.
You get more equitable resolution at the end, you get more evidence.
So let's start one by one. Let's go slowly. Yeah, so let's talk about this Aleph case. Now, let me just say a little more. The person, the people asked Reb Zalman Nechemya this question, they said, why would anybody agree to do pshara? Like, why not always pursue din, especially if you know you're in the right? Like, what's in it for the person telling the truth to agree to do pshara? So what is the answer? His first... point, Ariel?
That it would be too hard to get the other person because the whole case of Edom is so difficult with Jews that it would be too hard to get the whole case, so it's easier to just settle for us.
Yeah, so he quotes this, the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Shin Samechas. But the Shulchan Aruch says, under non-Jewish law, it's very easy to recover stolen property. Under Jewish law, it's almost impossible, right? Because the threshold of evidence is so... high. It's almost impossible. You could have two Edim, Lusal the Geneva, and then it's so difficult to prevail in a Jewish law case that even if it genuinely was stolen, the bar and the threshold of evidence is so strong, you're not going to be able to recover it. Now, what do you guys think of that? So Reb Zalman Nechemya says, well, that's a reason to do Pshara. And he suggested under Pshara, you could lower the threshold of evidence required. So the court can make a decision not based off testimony, but just based off what he calls umdina and weaker proofs. So he says in that case, it'll favor the person telling the truth. It was stolen, but the evidentiary bar would preclude you from recovering it under din. So that's why one case where pshara is very good. Do you guys agree with that or disagree with that? Okay, let's take Eitan and then Benji.
Doesn't that just get rid of the whole idea of din?
Yeah. Right, it's a little difficult. It's like, why is the din bar set through so high? Right? Yeah, and so I guess, Romeo, I was wondering if this is why you didn't like the first explanations, at least according to Kobe's report.
Yeah, no,
Well,
I wrote that that was inaccurate.
Yeah, right. But is that the reason why? Because so you're saying, wait, so Rabbi Zalman Nechem is saying Pshara is so great because it's very hard to prevail under din. But that only asks, like, well, then why is din set up in such a way that it's so hard for you to recover what's yours?
Yeah. Right. Really, I was afraid it was just like why is it necessarily a good thing? It could also it could work against, meaning you're favoring now the guy who's making the claim, so now maybe he can bring in more sketchy evidence. Like.
Right, but Rav Zalman Nechemi here seems to be celebrating the fact that there's a way to circumvent.
That's good is a big assumption.
Right.
And it basically led me to think, to basically read his argument as saying, if you assume that Pshara is good, then Pshara is good. Like, assume that Pshara is good because all these things that make common rights easier.
So, can we agree on this? Can we agree that it's bad if the Torah sets up a threshold of evidence that's almost impossible to meet in normal cases?
Well,
hold off on those. Hold up on the bench. Let's keep Ben Sarmor out of here for a minute, okay? let's stay with the easy cases, right? Isn't it bad if the system of din is set up in a way that a person can prevail on a genuine claim about theft? I guess it depends what din is for, but I think this point is consistent with saying almost like, yes, din is not meant. Like take the Riaz's paradigm. Sometimes it's not good to pursue din if under that system you're not going to get the right answers. You like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're at odds with your Chavrusa on this. Mm-hmm. You're at odds with your Chavrusa on this. Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. So anybody else like this example of Zalman Nechemia? That's a pretty interesting. Benji, you liked it?
I was going to say that you can change that to the exact opposite question then. The Magen Degana agrees with Shara.
Yeah, why would the Gan have agreed to
Pshara?
Sure,
because the evidentiary standard is so high.
Yeah. That's a good question. So we'll see at the end. I think Rav Zalman Nechemi tries to address that.
Think of the lawyer thing?
Yeah. The lawyer thing. Yeah. Okay, so that's number one. So I think this is just so fascinating because so far, we've seen people praise Pshara in terms of shalom, things like that. It could give you a good resolution. Here, the point seems to be it's almost like Pshara achieves the truer result rather than din. Right? Din wouldn't get at the true result because of the procedural bar. Make sense? Yeah. I think that can be read into the Riaz's point that lefamim, sometimes it's kasha lelech achar adin. Let's look at his second point. So, number two. What does he talk about in section number two? Also a very fascinating theory. So, anybody familiar with Kimli? And so, when you have machlokes haposkim, so there's a whole range of views out there. How do you decide which view is authoritative to decide a given case? I could say that's probably the most important question of halachic jurisprudence. In the American system, you know, the courts are pretty clear about if you have a majority vote. But in halacha, you have all these different poskim who say different things. What do? You just tally them up. But we have a principle of ein holchim mamon achar rov. So some poskim think, yeah, that basically ties your hands. Anytime there's a shita that is consistent with the defendant's position, you're barred from being motzi mamon. That's the idea of a kimli, that the defendant could always say, well, I hold like this view that's out there, and you have no right to force me to give it up according to other views. So Rav Zalman Nechemi says, yeah, that's true under din. Under din, you might say, you need some very strong halachic evidence to say that a position is normative to be motzi mamon. But under pshara, you could get away with much less. So you could get away with the Beis Din relying on maybe a slim majority of poskim, or even on a majority view, if they're deciding it according to Pshara. Did anybody catch that in this discussion? So what do you make of that? So the thought here is that if you apply Din, it's almost impossible to be motzi mamon. Whereas if you apply Pshara, then it's much easier to be motzi mamon against somebody who, I guess, the Beis Din clearly thinks is in the wrong. Yes? It's structurally parallel to the first point he makes, but it's not about like the factual evidentiary threshold. It's more about the evidentiary threshold for saying this halachic position is binding on this case. Rami?
Again, I just don't understand. It's like there are a bunch of dinim in the, or halacha, whatever, in the Gemara and in halacha, and then the assumption that he's making is basically getting rid of those is good.
Getting?
Getting rid of those principles that we generally follow is good.
Yeah.
Well, then, why are they principles?
Well, you could ask the same question on the Riyaz, who said that lefamim is kasha lele chacharadin.
But I can explain that philosophically, I think.
Okay, and this you can't explain philosophically?
No. I mean...
Why not?
I'm saying I could just use the same explanation.
Well, let's hear the explanation.
Right, I was going to say, like, yeah, the concept of din is that there's an ideal standard, and then there are more complex cases that can't meet that standard. And you're saying I have to just sort of apply that here.
Yeah, you could say something like that. This is, you know, din is some ideal standard... But sometimes, you know, justice and fairness itself requires to depart from that standard. No? I don't know.
I think maybe that's what Romy's having difficulty with. The Riyaz is saying, okay.
You might say, in an ideal world, we would have a consensus amongst poskim, right? So you wouldn't have these minority views that, in an ideal world, maybe all poskim would get along and come out to the same result. But so maybe din could work in that society. But if you live in a society where there's a shita for everything, then that really locks the hands of justice, right?
I guess it's
higher than Rumi.
I think it's one thing to say, like, kosher lele chacharadin, that, okay, fine, the final output of din is kind of a result that, like, we can't handle. It's much more severe to say, oh, the principle X is just a bomber for true justice. As in, like, kasha lelech al edus, so let's just not have edus. Kasha lelech al kimli, so the principle of kimli we don't like. As in, he's attacking the principle itself, he's not attacking just kind of the consequentialist.
Well, maybe the principle of kimli is sometimes a bar to true justice, not always. Meaning, if in fact the defendant is in the right, then kimli's great. Right? It's good to be hard to emote, for it to be hard to emote mamon. But then there are those cases where he's a real crook, right? And he acted in bad faith, but he's got a shita that says, you know, whatever. You know, maybe you need a workaround in that type of case. No?
I mean, like, seems like he's pretty broadly attacking, like, Adas and minority.
He's taking on the whole system.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, Adas, this is like, or like, I don't know. I mean, his point about, like, finding Eden to shame him was also a big one. It's like, yeah, like, having kosher Eden is, like, a huge deal.
Yeah. That's just a question on Din. Why is Din set up this way?
Right.
I don't see a fundamental distinction between the cases. I mean, in both cases, so, like, in both cases, you're saying, here's the principle under Din, and it's just not, doesn't work well in all cases. So, he's saying Pshara solves that. And you both think there's a difference between case A and case B. Yes? Sorry, do you?
I'm not sure. I think if you say, like, so see, like, your Kimta in the article here, that, like, I don't know, he's not destroying, he doesn't think Avis is always bad and always blocks justice. It's just sometimes, or Kimley's not always bad. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. How do I zoom in? Just with the keyboard?
Control plus, probably.
Control plus?
Or if you move the mouse, it should be a little menu up here. Move the mouse around, yeah.
Okay, great. Let's zoom in on Reis Lamechbab for a second. Here he says the idea of Reb Shimon Shkap. Right, Dino Shel Sumchus, who holds Mamon Amut Abasafik Cholke in his Pshara. And then he says, Bezeh Vada Eino Din. This for sure is not Din. So why is that? What's Reb Zalman Nechemi's argument for why Yachloku can't be Din? Josh? Yeah, he says, Kishena Chaluka Yecholios MS. When it's inconsistent with truth that both parties actually own half, that makes it that it can't be din. I just want to point out, he's assuming that what's the conception of din? Yeah, or at least the pursuit of getting at the true resolution. To my mind, that's not obvious. I just don't know why it's obviously the case that din is associated with the capacity for arriving at the true result, as opposed to some other feature of law, right? That it's this is the rule. This is the halachic rule. Now, true, at Midrashim there are connections, nasa din, nasa emes. So maybe he's working off that. But that's definitely the... So his thought is, pshara, I guess, is a resolution not grounded in getting at the right result, whereas din is about rules trying that at least attempt to get at the most correct or factually true legal resolution. Is that the idea, Josh?
Wait, this might be going on a tangent, but I feel like you have to bring up, like, you know the thing that Ruby ends up chasing after Shimon with a knife and then they go, like, behind the wall?
Yeah.
I feel like that kind of shows that din isn't really about, like, convincing us, like, what the MS is, because in that case it's obvious and we still say no, right?
There's even more than that.
Yeah, it seems like it's not about being convinced. In that case, we are convinced. Din is about something else. It's about, like, creating an MS or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of room to fruitfully speculate, but I don't have enough to right here. I'm just saying, Reb Zalman Nechemiah throws out this possibility. It's fine. It's reasonable. Not so persuaded by it though. Kobe,
just to push back a little bit, it could be a difference.
Push back on
his example.
On Josh,
it could be a difference in what are intended between getting mom and getting the fascia. But getting the fascia, we usually lean on the side of like not like punishing people because like, we don't want to.
Yeah, that's possible. That's very fair. But Josh is saying maybe there should be a unified conception of, you know, what the MS is saying now.
It doesn't seem to be, like, we see in the first that they that we try and get out of having to punish people at all time. And then Mark, we talk about like all the stories in between for why it wasn't him, even when it's clear to him.
Yeah,
it seems that we have a different. The goal of the
budget
is not quite the same.
That's fair. I still, what I'm struggling with personally, just kidding, I don't struggle with things personally. but what I've been pondering, what I think I'm struggling with in that, in Zalman Nechemiah's analysis is the law is not in, it's not a passive observer to like true legal things. So it's not like there's some true conception of who owns this and the law is just ratifying that. Like what's yours and what's mine is a function of what the law says is yours and mine. So it's not like, oh, there's a question of ownership and then Yish Shalomidas is just trying to figure out whether you lost your owner. No, the rule of Yish Shalomidas determines whether or not you still own the thing. So I just think that this notion here about the din is about trying to get to MS, as if the din is an impartial observer, like watching this realm of MS take place, like of true ownership. And to my mind, that's a chimera, because no, like the realm of true ownership is determined by the legal rules that assign it. Sorry, you're sympathetic to that.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of like the shot I posted in the group. We'll get to it. But
yeah.
That's just kind of, or like the rest we saw earlier a few shiurim ago, like, oh, yeah, the din is like, oh, maybe Har Sinai. It's already been paskin, and then it's like, we just
apply
like,
it.
Sort of, right, the sort of concept that, like, I mean, I guess it's a little different. But
right, so I'm thinking the Cheskes Gimel Shanim example. Yeah, the law is that you lose your, you're no longer the owner if you allow somebody to squat in there for 3 years without a macha. That's not a suffix halacha. That's just a theory of ownership, that ownership doesn't survive if you're so removed from your possession.
Why?
Why what?
What's the underlying principle of ownership that says that should be true?
You're asking Taim Amitzah's questions.
I think that's
No, I'm just kidding. I just you asked your question so smugly, I thought I should have a smug response. That's all of us. Say it again.
I didn't mean it. I'm just... What underlying principle of ownership says that you lose your rights if you're away for 3 years?
He's saying it's the law itself.
Right, the law, that's the din. I'm saying the din is that bilus terminates if you're a certain degree removed from your possessions. Right?
No, I actually think, okay.
My point is that it's not that there's a question, oh, do you own it or do you not own it?
Well,
and the halacha is trying to help us get to the right understanding of those true facts.
Well, you're essentially saying that there's no philosophical justification for why this thing is true, which is about what it's true.
No, not that there's no philosophical justification, I'm saying, but it's not a Suffolk issue. It's the law assigning ownership. Right, so we're saying that the halacha is saying that ownership, it's no longer yours if you're not mocha. It's not that maybe it's yours, maybe it's not yours. We can't know. So there's this rule of cheskas gemal shanim. Right, the rule of cheskas gemal shanim alters what is your property and what is not your property.
But how do you put it with all those?
So, for example, in all these Safe cases, right? I think the point is that if there's a lost object that two people pick up at the same time, so when there's just indeterminacy about the ownership, the law assigns half of it to each party that's holding on to it. What do you mean that can't be true?
Why? But, I mean, the question is...
It's true in that it's the rule of the system.
Yes, but that's what I'm saying. The question is who owns it.
They each own half.
We each own half, now they don't know who really owns it.
Right.
So then we're doing the same thing. You just are calling it... It's the same with Chesed Lashonim. Meaning, how do you explain the fact that Tzvei Lom Yisdara B'Shtarah? Meaning, the reason you have it is because the guy took a loan to the Shtarah for that long. So, it's not because you actually are the owner. The question is, you really should have a Shtarah that says you're the owner and not determined ownership.
We're going to have to get into the Cheskas Abatim nuts and bolts. Everybody at least have a grasp on some of the tension here? No? A little bit? Benji does, so. If any questions, go to Benji. He'll explain it to you. Josh, you have a hand before we can move on?
Yeah, I was just gonna ask, you don't think there's like anything fundamental about it? Like if the law decided that anyone named Josh gets to steal anything from anyone named Shmuel, like you don't think that would be like contrary to the real property rights? Like I think that would be a law that goes against property rights that are assumed. Someone named Josh, even with the law, is not allowed to just take anything from someone named Shmuel.
I think if the halacha assigned ownership
in that way, you think it would be like real?
Yeah.
The halacha assigns a basin to mafia or anything you want.
If the halacha says that an ani could take your property, that means it's the ani's property. That you got it because, you know, it happened to, you happened to plant a tomato seed in your backyard and the rain helped it grow. Like, why does that make it more yours?
That seems radical to me to say that.
I just don't understand what your pre-legal conception of ownership
is.
I
don't know what that would be, but it just seems radical to say that it doesn't exist. I don't know.
Think so? Okay. Yeah.
Really, you think it does exist.
It's altered.
Alter it. Yeah,
right. Yeah, that's my view, right?
That's true, but even if that's true, that's not because it's the objective owner. It's because it's how Allah is telling us to move forward.
What's the objective owner outside
of... Illegal. It's not like there's no, like... Allah observes cases and then says... Like, what is the halacha in the given
tzias? Right. But those are facts. Here's a fact pattern. So, who's the owner?
Right.
The halacha assigns ownership rights.
Right. But the question is not... Yeah, so a mode of the halacha assigns ownership rights. The question is, sometimes, or I'm arguing, that sometimes the halacha assigns ownership rights based on fundamental principles of actual ownership, and sometimes it assigns rights based on the situation and how we need to move forward, even if, really fundamentally, Halacha says you own something because you have a shtar, or you own something because you're told you have it. Now, what happens when it's unclear? You know, you don't have a shtar, but you have a reason for not having it, or you're told it's the object, but somebody else has an explanation for why you're told it, even though it's not yours. So Halacha says, okay, we can't just go away from those fundamental principles of shtar or tfisa. We have to now say, you know, move forward with using this also, you know.
I'm saying that's a legal rule, right? That's
it is, yes. That's what I'm saying. All you're saying is that, it's just that it's a legal rule, and yes, it's a legal rule.
Right.
The question is, does it have this? Is it a social, like, let's figure out and move forward because society needs to function, or is it a...
Right, but I'm trying to figure out when these achronim are worried about the role of MS, I think I'm a little confused about what conception of MS they're appealing to. So it's like, halacha has to be consistent with the true ownership? What does that mean? Halacha assigns true ownership. Are they trying to say that the halacha shouldn't incentivize people to lie? Maybe.
No, you're just acknowledging that the achloku functions as halacha putting forth a din that is responding to the complex situation, as opposed to a din that's just fundamental rights, ownership. Even though both are actually, yes, now you own it moving forward.
Okay. I think there's more to tease out here, but I see where you're coming from. Benji?
Don't we say like there are these concepts of like pre-Harsinai concepts, like there's an idea of like what is a pre-Harsinai Isha looks like and what's a pre-Harsinai Nevershin. And you have like pre-Harsinai ownership, and that's why certain kinyanim can, like, you, if you're doing a kinyan with a goy, you're limited to
a Shiva. And you think something like that is going on here? These pre-legal conceptions, pre-Torah conceptions?
I think so. I mean, what, so then why...
Ned got very excited by something you said. Either that or Niggin just popped into his head. He's very excited by something you said. He started pounding on his table. Ned, are you excited by what Benji said? Or?
I'm saying this is the broader issue that you're going to have to come to at some point.
I'm like forced to deal with it? I have no Bukhira anymore? Or that... What?
What was that?
No, sorry. Go ahead,
Francie. No, so I guess the point is, like, why is it that those things are true before the Torah? If the Torah is the only thing that determines, legal status of things.
Yeah.
No, there is some sort of, natural order of, when you do a Kenyan Chazaka on something, this, it's a real pre-Harsinai demonstration of Bali. So,
I like how real, in your mind, goes to the pre-Harsinai appellation.
Yes. That's why I
one could have thought the opposite way, right?
Yeah, that's why I had to, when I said real, I put the parentheses. Like,
right.
And so when the Torah comes, it's not coming to be so tear those things that, we justify those real or emet or whatever.
Right.
So
the non-MS is the Torah.
The non-MS is the Torah. The Torah
is See, this is what happens when you start going in the high seas of theology, right?
I don't know. You pointed out that Torah is a chiddush, no? Like, before Torah, there wasn't Torah. Now there's Torah.
Yeah.
I'm not working before the world, though. So
I need to think that through, Benji. Let me think about it. We'll pursue that separately. On page Reis Samach Zayin, Reb Zalman Nechemya gives us further insight into the virtues of Pshara. So section Hay, what does he talk about here in section Hay? What does he talk about here, Kobe?
Cases where you're Chaya B'dinei
Shemayim and Pata B'dinei Adam. And he says that Pshara does what?
Pshara is a good thing to do. So like, that way people who are Chaya B'dinei Shemayim will actually end up paying to the amount that the guy that damaged
once he paid, unless you forgive them, and he kind of latched on the concept of, like, you can only forgive if you forgive him, so they don't look avero, if you fight, you look avero. Yeah, so he says here, I thought this was a tremendous chiddush, that if you're doing a case according to Pshara, that licenses the court to issue an award for a chiyah b'dei shemayim. Did you guys, isn't that what he says? At least to the amount that is reasonable for the other party to be mochel you for the offense, right? That's a pretty radical idea, no? So he's saying that, the Bezin now has the power just to be mechai for Dinei Shemayim, to make people happy with each other? Is that
what? I get to agree, I assume you
get to opt in, sort of, I assume, no? Like, yeah, so you say, hein l'din, hein l'pshara, be mefasher. Right, do pshara. So he's saying, they could just do even for a chiyah b'dei shemayim, they could issue an award.
So it's a clarity. The two people go and agree that something needs to be done here. There's no pshara.
So he's saying that's fine. Yeah, it's very interesting. I would just say, so the idea is that under din, this award would not be issued, but under pshara, now it could. Right. So the idea is that, look, as between the relationship of the parties, that has to be remedied. So under Pshara, the Bezdin could be mechayev something for it. But in terms of the actual, like, legal issues at bar and in the case, there's no basis to mechayev. Yes? Yeah. Notice here, would you characterize this as a type of lefnim mishuras adin? To pay up for a chiyah b'dei shemayim? Or do you think this is a separate type of consideration? So would you characterize section Hay as lefnim mishuras adin, or maybe, I don't know. So it's something to keep in mind, because remember we saw Pshara itself is sometimes characterized as lefnim mishuras adin, and then we're going to see a debate later on about whether Bezin can mechayev for lefnim mishuras adin. So it's a question to try to figure out, is are those concepts separate from each other? Right? Shara being a type of Fnibishiros HaDin, and then this idea that some case should be decided according to Fnibishiros HaDin. But I think this idea of Reb Zalman Nechemia fits nicely. Yeah, there are some cases where Din doesn't give you the full resolution because it doesn't deal with Chiv and Bidei Shemayim at all. And this is a nice way to have a Bidei Adam solution to obligations that are otherwise just Chiv and Bidei Shemayim. Anybody else have thoughts on this case? Simon Hay or Sif Hay? Dov, did you have thoughts on this case?
That if the whole point is you can't get it when you go to him and he's going to be punished otherwise, then why the whole idea that a partial payment should work seems strange.
A partial payment?
It seems to be saying.
He's saying the amount is the amount at which.
Then why have a bezin do it? He can do it himself. If it's a part payment, then even that part payment is entirely based on the fact that he can't collect the whole thing anyway. How that would fix it.
So in Sif Hay, he says that Pshara is a payment for the Mechilas HaToveya.
I don't think there's really a Mechila there as much as he's not going to get the money otherwise. You're getting 50, that's it, you better be happy with it. That's not really a Mechila, that's more of, I might as well get something.
Right. How much can we buy you out for your Mechila for? Right. Interesting concept, though. And you know, I think this is a really interesting additional consideration that Reb Zalman Nechemia adds to the values or virtues of Pshara. Okay? Should we turn to Romy's favorite part of the piece? Yeah? So, Sif Vav. What does Reb Zalman Nechemia say here? An English version of this article was just published in Tradition, by the way, if anybody wants to look at the English version. You guys found the English version?
No,
Eitan, you did what?
I was taken aback when it was in Hebrew. When I said article, I just assumed it was in English. I was a little disappointed.
Guys,
well, you posted the English article.
Did I?
Because you could see the whole folder of all the stuff you put in there.
In the Babasra folder?
Yeah, it's actually up there.
I don't know.
Yeah. I'd have to minus this.
No, on the right.
What? Oh, you opened it? Well? Oh, that's great. Great job. Oh, I see. I opened it separately. But you have it open here. Genius. It's great job, Zaharia.
Let's get to the fox.
Yeah, the fox. So let's talk about section Vav. So what does he say here? Rami, tell it to us since...
That Shara is good because otherwise we're going to waste all the money on lawyers and fighting and then spend more than they
actually have. Yeah, and this is Maisim B'chol Yom. I mean, this really happens all the time. You know, you have lawyers who are collecting $50,000 to litigate a dispute over $10,000. And it's, and there are crazy statistics about how more money is spent on attorney's fees than is ever recovered in tort cases. Meaning, which basically means that the people who win, the only winners in the legal system are the lawyers, right? And I thought this story with Irv Cook is such a very it's a very rich way of bringing out. So tell us the story just for fun.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So somebody asked Irv Cook that.
Should we look at it in English? Since. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know why you were told it is. He said somebody asked Irv Cook why you like your Jewish law and like settles for like basically has like all these arbitration and things like that, so settling for like actually what the real principles are.
Right, I mean, the ruling in a Jewish court seems so easy, right? It's you don't litigate for years on the details, right?
So he says that he brought the mashal that is...
Somebody in my neighborhood told me he spent $30 million like litigating a claim for like $30,000 or something. It's like something crazy like that.
He ended up
winning, but like he said he's like so
why
much...
Did you
why did you... Why well, because if had he lost... Sorry, the claim was for more, but he ended up paying like $30,000, but he spent like millions over like 8 years litigating this this dispute. Go ahead.
So the marshal is that a wolf kills a sheep and and like then a lion comes and says, I'm the king of the jungle or whatever, so give it to me. And he says, no, I'm the Carter, give it to me. So bring it to the fox to be the judge. And the fox, you know, realizes that...
We'll split it.
Oh, sorry, yeah, it says split it.
Yeah.
And they realize that the pieces aren't equal.
The split's uneven, right.
Right, so he takes a little bit of this and then a little bit of that one, and then ends up being just bones and...
Yeah, by the time he's done with it, there's nothing left to litigate. It's such a great little parable. Right? I got a lot of pleasure out of reading this. And this is so true. And so Zalman Nechemiah says, oh, that's the virtue of Pshara. Right? That you could get to this simpler way of evaluation without having to pay all the shamayim, getting this... As it happens, as fate would have it, on the train in this morning, somebody called me. He's like, oh, I'm in Beis Din for something. And, you know, one of these Dayanim in Brooklyn, you know, he just decided that he's going to, you know, like, Google the value of the property, you know, on his own. Or, like, you know, do some Hamish way of trying to figure out the value. He's like, it's like, that's crazy. What world is that normal? He's like, I need a halacha that shows me he can't do that. But it's just funny reading this Reb Zalman Nechemiah piece. Reb Zalman Nechemiah seems to be saying that's a value. That's a virtue, at least. That you don't spend well. Yeah, that's the kind of thing. I was like, well, I guess it depends what he's talking about. I guess if it's a petty thing, if it's $20 or $50, fine. Or if it's $100,000, but yeah, it really depends on the costs versus the value of the thing that's being litigated over. But you don't want like a $15 million property to be like, you know, his einus ktsas on it. But this is really fascinating. And he says this is a virtue of pshara, right? Because if you're under a din, then you have to go through the very strict evaluation process and it gets cumbersome and expensive. Why is this so fascinating? Because, somebody help me out, what's different about this type of reason than the prior reasons? I guess it's similar, Romy.
More like external or secondary? Like it's not really about why pshara... This is basically just saying, independent of whether or not Pshar versus Din, like, it's not about actually the law that the conclusion being better, right? So, there's other examples where
good.
It's,
so it's
a better conclusion because it's either it allows more evidence, or what was it, right? Or allows to use principles that get the fair.
Shitas Yachid, right, or no.
And this is saying it's really not about the end result of that ruling being fairer or more productive, something like that.
It's just about the costs. Right? So it's just about the costs. So notice this gets us to this notion of the administrability of justice, meaning in how this is not about the substantive issues in a debate between the parties, in a fight between the parties. This is literally just about a rule. So Romy's pointing out that in other cases, it's all about, oh, the winning party could win with less evidence, right? Things like that. Here, it's just about the overall cost of the system. So number one, that's an economic consideration, right? I mean, it's like we want it to not be expensive to litigate, correct? Yes? So I think that's a very insightful point. Some people don't like that. Some people say, what do you mean? It's din, and the whole point of din is that you, like, spend $1 million to get to the truth. Like, that's the beauty of it. It's all about getting to the right result. Who cares about the cost? So when you think about it from a pragmatic perspective, like, that's ridiculous. Right? It's ridiculous to spend so much money to settle the truth about some petty financial dispute. No? So I like that Reb Zalman Nechemiah thinks that it's a bona fide or a genuine halachic consideration that the system not be unwieldy or at least have the capacity to, you know, not be absurdly expensive to get at resolving disputes. Now, he's only saying that under pshara. He's saying it's a virtue of pshara that it allows disputes to be settled in a cost-efficient way. Right? Isn't that very fascinating? Zolti, and then Josh.
Well, I was saying that it's kind of fits into the whole, like, you could claim that, right, if you want Pshara to be a whole basis of, like, oh, it creates shalom, then, right, it's under that archetype, I guess, right? Then by losing out because you go on for din opposed to
as opposed to saving money through all the litigation that occurs. That's good. Like, you're going to be a happier person.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. So it fits nicely within that scheme of shalom,
right?
And satisfying the preferences of the parties, that the process is not as cumbersome. Yeah, I think that's a great point that Daniel's making. Does everybody hear Daniel's point? Yeah? Josh?
I don't like it as much because I feel like it's, you know, if they want to spend $1 million on lawyers, then, you know, that's their prerogative. Like, you know.
You don't think it's Baltashvis or
no, I don't.
You're getting at the truth.
Yeah, and I also don't see why this also can't be an expensive process of trial, where, you know, you're still making your case as to why you
yeah.
have more or whatever. Like, lawyers are naturally going to get involved in that stuff too.
Yeah, it's interesting. But he's saying, look, at least on the evaluation process, there's a kind of cheaper way of doing this.
Yeah,
you can see how sometimes that's useful, at least.
Yeah, but that, to, you know, to who? Who's it useful to? Like, if I'm saying that this is the way that I
want
to do it, you know, I'm happy to put you in the ground with my 50 lawyers, then that's what I want.
Yeah. So when we do our sheer play, playing out the Rav Zalman Nechemia story, you can be the fox that takes a bite out of everyone's portion. Because you're sympathetic to that view. Yes? Yeah, in the pursuit of justice, right? That's the beauty of the story, right? The fox is pursuing justice as he eats away at everybody else's savings, right? All right, so that's it for the Pshara discussion. So just to summarize very briefly, the three main things we discussed today. Number one, we saw sources that emphasize the shalom aspect of din. Right? That, you know, if you think Pshara is related to din in some cases, din itself has a shalom as a value. Number two, we saw cases where the din is explicitly underwritten by Pshara according to Rav Shimon Shkap's theory in Shari Yosher, those Yachloku cases. Even in the Yachloku cases, just want to point out, some of them might just be pure Pshara type, okay, it's a suffix, we'll split it. I think the Sfina case is a little more than that. The Sfina case, I think, is closer to the Gemara in Sanhedrin Lamed Aleph, where it's a Yachloku based on what's a rational decision given the impossibility of either party moving forward in a useful way? So I think it's a bit of a qualitatively different type of yachloku. So just think about that. It's not just, oh, it's a suffix, we'll split it. It's that there's no other rational solution where the parties can move forward without a bad incentive. And then finally, we looked at Rav Zalman Nechemia's discussion, which I think is certainly the most mechudash. And I think the best way to think of his solution, his approach to the values of Pshara, is consistent with the Riyaz, that lif'amim it's kasha lelecha achar din, either because din would get at the wrong result given the threshold of evidence, given the fact that din is biased always toward the defendant, given the exploitation of a tainas kimli, and how the shitos align. The inclusion of moral considerations, like chiyah b'dinei shemayim, that those could be settled through pshara, not through din. And then the inclusion of the costs of administrating justice being itself a halachic consideration in favor of pshara. So that's it for our pshara discussion. All of this just to explain the Yad Ramah's view about what's going on in the Runyas story. Okay, and more, because it's very recurring themes that we'll talk about later on. So what we're going to talk about on Thursday is we're just going to discuss the achronim in the view of the Ramah, about if you're toveya less than what you're entitled to, should the Bezin award you the true amount or the amount you're toveya. Just want us to think, is that related to Pshara in any way? Okay? And then, no one wants Shir on Wednesday, right? And no one wants Shir on Wednesday and Friday? I'm trying to think if I should sneak in the second Runya case before I go to Israel. It's always bad when I do that, so let's not do that. And as a general rule, if I ever ask to go overtime, just say no, because it's bad policy. So if I say, oh, I'm going to take 5 minutes, just say no, no, no. No problems. All right, let's stop here, and we'll pick up on Thursday.